Markets Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Two bills that would limit or restrict transgender athletes' participation in sports are moving through the Republican-controlled state legislature. One focuses on K-12 sports, the other on college athletics at UW schools and technical colleges.
Yesterday, lawmakers convened for a public hearing at the state capitol in Madison. The hearing lasted for more than 6 hours. It included discussion of a third bill regarding medical gender transition for minors.
WPR's state capitol reporter Anya Van Wagtendonk was at the hearing, joins us now for a discussion of these bills and the questions they raise about trans youth in sports. Anya, welcome back to the show.
Good morning.
So in March of last year, the hearings for these bills, they were long, they were heated. What was the mood in the room like at yesterday afternoon's public hearing?
Yeah, definitely also impassioned, maybe a little bit less long, but still quite long, as you mentioned. And it was impassioned on both sides, but especially, I think, on the part of the community that was there to testify against the bills. So sort of LGBTQ activist groups and individuals, their mood also seemed a little bit more tired. And there was kind of a theme in their testimony that they feel like they keep coming back to these same issues to protest these same bills that they describe as an attack on kids. And by that same token, you know, the folks supporting the bills, they also argue that they are supporting kids. And so there was quite a lot of that energy kind of on both sides.
So let's look at the bills themselves. Two bills focusing on transgender athletes at the high school and college level of sport. What would they do specifically?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, one is for K-12 schools, the other is for public colleges and universities, and essentially both say that you cannot play on a sports team that doesn't match the sex you were assigned at birth, so sort of whatever the doctor wrote on your birth certificate, but they especially specify that people who were born male cannot play on girls and women's sports teams and cannot use girls' or women's locker rooms. The current policy in Wisconsin changed about a year ago overall, so this would be a little bit stricter, and again, has that focus on locker rooms.
Right, because the Wisconsin Interclassic Athletic Association and the NCAA, they've updated their policies to comply with an executive order from the Trump administration barring transgender girl athletes from competing on teams that don't correspond with their sex at birth on their birth certificates. Why do lawmakers seek additional laws at the state level?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, there is that locker room specification. The policy, the WIAA and the NCAA policies that changed about a year ago, you know, those are rules about competition. They say that athletes born male can only compete on a boys or men's team, but anyone of any gender can compete on boys' teams if they qualify, and there can still be mixed gender practice. This one, again, has that locker room distinction, which I think is quite central, but it also talks about participation on sports teams. It doesn't distinguish between competition and practice, so it's a little bit stricter.
Okay, as you are well aware, we're in an election year. Why is transgender participation in sports a legislative priority for Republicans here at the start of 2026?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been a priority for a little while. This actually is not the first legislative session that these bills have come through. Governor Tony Evers has already vetoed virtually the same bills last legislative session, and the assembly version of these same bills passed a year ago after those impassioned hearings that you mentioned earlier. But I think that national context of that election year is that this has been a really significant part of President Donald Trump's cultural agenda. He signed executive orders on this issue pretty immediately after he took office. And so I think Wisconsin Republicans, you know, they're taking these up again, even though they know that Governor Evers is going to veto them. It signals that this issue matters to them, and then maybe also that they think it is a good winning issue for them heading into an election year.
Listening to lawmakers here, Republican Representative Scott Allen, a co-author, I mean, he seemed to stress that these bills are about allowing time for kids to develop. Can you talk about what you heard from bill sponsors?
Yeah, so he is a sponsor of the medical transition bill. And so there's an argument there that it's, again, about protecting kids, about allowing kids to develop and sort of become who they are before they make really significant changes to their bodies. And then with these sports bills that's also an argument around protecting kids and specifically around protecting girls and women's sports, that there's all of these benefits that sports offer to young people and that could be sort of taken away from women and girls if there is a change to the playing field. Of course, the people who oppose the bills say they agree that there's all these benefits to the sports. And so they want to maintain those benefits for as many kids as possible, including kids of different gender backgrounds.
We're talking about these bills about transgender participation in sports that are making their way through the state legislature. We have Anya Van Wagtendonk with us, WPR State Capitol reporter, who sat in on yesterday's hearing, public hearing about this legislation. So transgender athletes, they've expressed concerns about what this all means for youth participation in sports, especially those who might not have a, you know, traditional gender presentation. And under these bills, how are coaches supposed to verify the gender of participating athletes?
Yeah, that's not specified in the language of the legislation. And that's one thing that opponents of the bills really pointed to. You know, they said, are you going to do blood draws on students, or, you know, inspect their bodies, inspect private parts of their bodies? How will you choose who to inspect? You know, who will conduct those inspections? Senator Melissa Ratcliffe is a Democrat from Cottage Grove. She has a transgender child, and she testified against the bill, saying, you know, that they don't contain that information because they're not really an attempt at legislation. They're trying to send a message. The bill's authors responded to some of those questions, saying that these are details that can be worked out, or that different schools or different districts could implement different policies.
So many voices at yesterday's hearing, and I want to like hone in on just a couple here. This is testimony from someone who said they are a female athlete and an ambassador from the Christian group Young Women for America, which opposes transgender athletes in women's sports. Let's listen.
The question is whether women deserve fair opportunity to compete in protected spaces. Without sex-separated categories, women would not have scholarships, records, championships, and equal opportunity. I was never placed in a competition with a biological male. That is not a privilege, it is a right.
Is that the theme of the arguments that came up in support of these bills yesterday?
Yeah, I think that's a very good encapsulation of kind of that theme, which is that it's about protecting women's and girls' access to sports and all the kind of benefits that come with sports participation, things from emotional development, social development, all the way up to things like college scholarships or career opportunities. And the other kind of part of that argument is that biological males, you know, have certain inherent physical advantages. And so that, as that speaker just said, not having clearly delineated kind of gendered teams makes competition unfair or even dangerous.
Now, in opposition of these bills, we heard from a number of parents who turned out to testify yesterday. Let's listen to the message of a mother of a transgender daughter who gave testimony at the hearing.
What I really believe is that you're putting in place a policy that allows for adults to take a girl, say that they need to check their genitalia, and then look or feel that genitalia. You are putting in place a policy that will harm all of the girls, not just the transgender ones.
So this parent really sees a ripple effect in this emotional testimony. What did you take away from people who turned out to in opposition here?
Yeah, there was also kind of a range of arguments in that sense. So again, you know, what we just discussed in terms of the lack of details about how something like this could actually be sort of implemented or legislated. I think some fear around, again, what that would mean for students' privacy and things like that. And then the other argument is that actually two other arguments. One is that, you know, this is a quite rare occurrence, actually, that there are transgender athletes playing certainly at the high school or collegiate level. And so a lot of opponents say this is sort of a solution to a problem that doesn't exist, that is aimed at more so demonizing students of different gender backgrounds. And then the argument is that, again, that there's all of these benefits to sports participation. And so singling out certain types of students could have these ripple effects, not just on students of different gender backgrounds, but even on women and girls, just in terms of feeling safe and comfortable on sports teams.
So deeply personal issue to young people. Were there any trans athletes at the hearing who testified, and what did they say?
Some people did talk about, you know, again, participation on sports, not necessarily that they were high school or collegiate level competitive athletes. But again, I think that speaks to this broader issue, which is that the participation of trans athletes at those levels is quite rare. It's hard to study, but the NCAA in 2024 said that it's something like 10 trans athletes out of about 500,000 who play at the college level. So these debates do tend to focus on a handful of very high profile cases. cases, or they enter into much more kind of hypothetical debate.
Looking at the larger political stakes here, I was looking at the Trans Legislation Tracker website yesterday. Last year, more than 1,000 bills that would negatively impact trans people were being considered in nearly every state. Is Wisconsin falling in line with what is being introduced in state houses across the country?
I think certainly at the state house level, there have been a number of these kinds of bills either proposed or passed. As you mentioned, there was also a debate yesterday about gender affirming health care for minors. But the difference here compared to some of those other state houses is that there's a Democratic governor and a GOP controlled legislature. And so Tony Evers, the governor, has said that he will veto anything that he sees as targeting LGBTQ rights. And that includes versions of these bills that have passed before. He's vetoed them before. He has signaled that he'll veto them again.
And so what are the Republican authors of these bills hoping to achieve by pushing these bills back to his desk?
You know, I think it is about messaging. And as you mentioned, messaging in an election year, it sends a message to constituents and to voters. And these sports bills are popular. I think polling shows that a majority of people do support some version of gender restrictions in sports. And so if they're putting it forward, they must be kind of betting that this is a winning issue for them. And we've even seen some Democrats kind of nationally moderate on this issue. And so we're going to see this debate play out, I think, pretty significantly in this election year.
Quickly here, you're in a busy floor period. There are so many public hearings left and right each day. These bills already passed the assembly, hearing yesterday. Where does it go from here?
Yeah, so they already passed the assembly, and so now they'll need to get voted out of committee in the Senate and then passed at the Senate. And then, as I mentioned, Evers is going to veto them. But that broader debate, I think, will continue throughout the next year, and not just in Wisconsin, but nationally.
Anya, thank you so much for your work. Thanks for this update.
Thanks for having me.
Anya Van Wagtendonk is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. We've been talking about what took place yesterday at a more than 6-hour-long public hearing at the state capitol with bills targeting transgender athletes in focus.
Coming up, there's a new food pyramid and an update to federal nutrition guidelines. A Wisconsin dietitian says there are good recommendations there, along with some confusing messages.
Having that mixed messaging can confuse and erode trust, but the guidelines are not as different as the pyramid would suggest.
What should we eat? That's coming up next. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Trump administration recently unveiled new dietary guidelines, changing the food pyramid to put protein, healthy fats, and vegetables at the top.
Portions of the guidelines have gotten praised. For instance, the Wisconsin Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics said they support the move to avoid highly processed foods and refined carbohydrates.
But the organization and other nutritionists have raised concerns about the emphasis on foods high in saturated fat, like red meat, beef tallow, and butter.
To understand these changes to the dietary guidelines, we have Michelle King Reimer, a registered dietitian and clinical assistant professor at the Zilber College of Public Health at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Michelle, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Absolutely. Thank you for inviting me.
Before we start digging into the specifics of these guidelines, what are these guidelines? Where do they come from?
So the dietary guidelines for Americans are updated every 5 years. They are science-based recommendations, and truly they're meant to be a guide, kind of like a playbook for policies and program and schools and healthcare and individuals, rather than to be something that's specific to each individual. So this means that they shape federal nutrition programs like school meals and WIC, and ultimately policy follows this guidance. So it's really important for it to be clear.
We got an email question from J.O. who asks, what evidence and analysis lead to changes in dietary guidelines?
I love the question. So as I mentioned, the dietary guidelines are meant to be evidence-based, and they do truly shape how science is interpreted, summarized, and translated. And so until this cycle, the dietary guidelines followed a consistent pattern. So there was an independent advisory committee with nutrition experts. They would review the evidence, produce a scientific report, and then federal agencies would translate that report into policy. And so this really allowed for a clear boundary between scientific judgment and policy authority. I think a good example of that is thinking of it being similar to the separation of church and state. In the 2025-2030 cycle, the process changed. So although the advisory committee, those 20 nutrition experts, completed its report, the USDA and Department of Health and Human Services didn't use that report as primary scientific foundation. They relied on a separate scientific foundation built around, I would say, a different hierarchy of evidence while selectively incorporating conclusions from that expert panel.
We'll dig into some of the what those distinctions mean in a minute. But again, big picture for these guidelines, part of the challenge here isn't just, if I understand it correctly, hey, here's the latest science, but how do we communicate what we know from the latest research in a way that people can look at this and take action and work it into their daily diet? Is that an important part of these recommendations?
Absolutely. And I believe as well as just, again, emphasizing that the recommendations should be clear, evidence-based, and easy for the public to understand. But where we see the biggest profound impacts is in those federal nutrition programs such as school meals, school lunches.
So now let's get into these guidelines. You suggested that, hey, the process was different here and that led to some different outcomes. What are some of the things that have concerned you? First of all, when it comes to the messaging you're seeing around these guidelines.
Sure. Well, I think it's important to just highlight that there are many guidelines that haven't changed, right? Balance, variety, moderation continue to be key. And those align with the messaging that you should consume a large amount or, you know, consume a lot of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, lean proteins, healthy fats, in addition to limiting that added sugar, saturated fats, and excess sodium. So those things are still recommendations that were pulled over from the last five-year cycle. What I'm seeing are some shifts that potentially the messaging isn't clear or consistent with what is actually based in decades worth of literature, or also within the actual dietary guidelines themselves. One is the increase in protein recommendations. So recommendations now are about twice what was previously recommended in terms of protein intake. And while we know that protein needs are highly variable, most Americans are consuming more than enough protein. And consuming excess protein can still be converted to fat in your body, which ultimately leads to weight gain. So what's missing there is this clarity on the quality of different protein foods. And we know evidence continues to suggest plant-based proteins and fish are associated with more favorable outcomes than diets that are high in red meat. So when we eat a lot of high protein foods, we also get everything that comes alongside of that, correct? Like fats and fiber and sodium. So I like to think of it as this protein package. And that package is what likely makes the difference for health. If you, let's say you were going to have 4 ounces of sirloin steak, you will get about 33 grams of protein, and about 5 grams of that would be saturated fat. If you were then on the flip side going to consume a plant-based protein, so a cup of cooked lentils, you would get less protein, so about 18 grams of protein for that serving, but you also get 15 grams of fiber and virtually no saturated fat. So that protein package is what likely really makes that difference for our health.
On the topic of protein, we got an email from Dale who writes, hey, protein is very important. And there are, as you were just getting at, non-meat sources of protein. In the guidelines that we're getting now from the federal government and the way they're talking about them, is there enough emphasis, do you think, on those non-meat proteins, the lentils and things like that you just mentioned?
Correct. I would say, again, the language exists, right, that there are sources of meat and there's also plant sources to get protein. However, the order in which it's presented within the within the guidelines is it mentions meat and dairy first and then mentions plant-based proteins. Again, there's a bit of a mixed message if you even then consider looking at the new pyramid, is that meat, steak, dairy has been elevated to the top of the pyramid where you should, the visual tells you you should eat more of. And then you see the plant-based proteins are actually below that. So from a visual standpoint, it can be confusing to the consumer as well.
I wanted to talk about that upside-down pyramid because I'm a little baffled by it compared to what we've seen, the upright pyramid or the plate of food that was in a couple cycles there. There's an upside-down pyramid. I mean, just visually glancing at it without looking at any of the information that came along with it, if I look at it, I would look at it and say, hey, whole grain's down on the bottom under a line. I shouldn't eat whole grain. I don't think that's the message they're trying to send exactly. What do you make of that part of the visual communication of these guidelines?
Yes. Well, I would say that when visuals send mixed messages, then people are less likely to act on the guidance, and it also erodes trust. But what I would also say is that, you know, the fundamentals of healthy eating haven't changed nearly as much as the graphic suggests. So again, having that mixed messaging can confuse and erode trust. But the guidelines are not as different mm-hmm. as the pyramid would suggest.
We're talking about new dietary guidelines from the federal government. Michelle King-Reimer is with us, clinical assistant professor at the Zilber College of Public Health and UW-Milwaukee, registered dietitian. Michelle, one of the guidelines here, not too controversial, I think, is, hey, cut back on processed foods, ultra-processed foods. I think everybody in the nutrition world agrees on that. But how do we define, can we define what we mean when we say processed and ultra-processed foods?
Yes, there is a classification system that exists. It's called the NOVA classification system, and it categorizes foods into four groups based on their level of processing. And this classification helps us in understanding the nutritional quality and the health implications of different food types. So the new guidelines, I think, yes, you're correct. We can get behind reducing processed, ultra-processed foods. I think we need more clarity around this and to look at ultra-processed foods as maybe not forbidden, but as foods to be mindful of in our frequency and also in our portion.
Right. I think one of the things that can be safe to say in the nutrition world is we're never going to see guidance that says, hey, eat more chips and store-bought pastries and stuff like that. Much as I would love to see that guidance, we're pretty rock solid. We're never going to see these listed as the good foods on the pyramid, right?
Well, I would never say never based off of some of the images that are presented on our pyramid now. But I would agree with you is that reducing ultra-processed foods is an important step. And continuing to emphasize limiting added sugars is critical. We just need to make sure that our recommendations are clear, evidence-based, and easy for our public to understand.
All right. Now we've talked about ultra-processed foods. We've talked some about protein. Carbohydrates. There are different kinds of carbohydrates. They kind of get a bad rap in a lot of ways, especially based on some particular diets. What do you see in the new recommendations in carbohydrates? What do you actually suggest to people when it comes to the world of carbs?
This is a very pertinent question I get asked a lot. Are carbs bad? But I would say really another confusing element is how whole grains are visually represented. So decades of research have shown that whole grains are associated with lower risk of heart disease and diabetes and certain cancers. So the current visual, they appear at the bottom of the pyramid or the plate, and people may interpret that as eat less, even if that wasn't the intent. So when you choose whole grains, you want to make sure that you are choosing just what it says, whole grains, not the ultra processed white flour types of foods, chips, cookies, candies, things like that, but actually choosing those grains that provide fiber and vitamins and minerals.
I've seen out there, speaking of fiber, I've seen articles saying, hey, 2026 in the nutrition world may be the year of fiber. A lot more people recommending that. Of course, dietitians and nutritionists, I think, have been trying to get Americans to eat more fiber for many, many years. What is your advice for people when it comes to fiber? And do these new guidelines talk enough about the value of fiber?
Yes, the guidelines do mention increasing fiber, and I think that's consistent with the message to eat whole foods in terms of consuming fruits and vegetables and plant-based proteins such as legumes and nuts and seeds, along with whole grains. And so I believe you're right. Most people do not consume enough fiber. My students always keep me up to date on the newest TikTok trends. And recently one of those was more of a fiber loading trend. So again, as you increase fiber in your diet, just make sure that you are also increasing water as well.
I want to return to something we touched on earlier, saturated fats. You mentioned, you know, in that red meat, if you're eating that to get your protein, you're getting some saturated fats. I think some of the oils, the beef tallow and things like that, that at least the Secretary of Health and Human Services is recommending, are going to come with saturated fat. Now, as I understand it, please correct me if I'm wrong, the words in these guidelines don't necessarily say, hey, eat more saturated fats than you used to. Some of the messaging, though, seems to say, hey, maybe they're not as bad as we used to say. What are you seeing there?
That's correct. The words that are written, you know, what within the guidelines indicate that you should limit your saturated fat consumption to no more than 10% of daily calories. However, one concern many nutrition scientists share is that decades of high quality research that consistently link higher saturated fat intake to increase cardiovascular risk has just kind of disappeared. And so when the visual or the recommendation appears to soften that message, especially by elevating foods that are traditionally high in saturated fat to the top of that pyramid, it can create confusion for the public. So I think it's important to think about, you know, the scientific debate exists, but the weight of evidence still supports limiting saturated fat as a heart healthy strategy. Another, as it pertains to saturated fat, the new recommendations also suggest consuming full fat dairy. However, that's inconsistent with the recommendation to stay below 10% of your daily calories if you are consuming the recommended servings of dairy per day. So I believe that it would be difficult to stay below 10% of your daily calories from saturated fat if you consume 3 full fat versions of dairy per day. For example, if you had, you know, 1 cup of whole milk, a 3/4 cup of full fat Greek yogurt, and 1 ounce of cheese, you're already at 17 grams of saturated fat. And if we're considering this for a 2000 calorie a day diet, you're almost to your limit of 22 grams per day. So if you add a single tablespoon of butter or beef tallow that has been suggested as an option, you're going to overconsume saturated fat for that day.
Now, as a classic Wisconsinite, I'll have anywhere from 3 to 7 different kinds of cheese in my fridge at a time. But, you know, I'm not eating them a block at a time. That's where that moderation comes in, right? A little bit of these things, if we're not having full servings, might not be such a disaster.
Absolutely. Moderation is key. It's important to recognize that full-fat dairy fits within your diet, depending on the other types of foods that you're consuming throughout the day. But we should also keep in mind that low-fat dairy remains a practical, evidence-based way to reduce saturated fat and calories. And really, ultimately, regardless of fat level, added sugar in dairy products matter just as much.
Finally, I hear in the public a lot of confusion, I think, when it comes to, well, wait, what am I supposed to eat? What are my dietary guidelines? I'm guessing as a dietitian, you hear that even more. What is the biggest point of confusion you hear from people that you'd want to, having this platform, that you'd want to clear up for them?
Well, my advice is to focus less on any single graphic and more on a consistent theme that hasn't changed, and that's eat plenty of fruits and vegetables, choose whole grains often, include a variety of protein sources, limit added sugars, and also be mindful of saturated fat. And those principles are still strongly supported by decades of research. But ultimately, healthy eating should support enjoyment, energy, and the quality of your life, not be stressful.
Michelle, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Michelle King-Reimer is a clinical assistant professor at the Zilber College of Public Health at UW-Milwaukee. We've been talking about a new food pyramid and new nutrition guidelines from the federal government.
Still to come, singer-songwriter Skylar Grey grew up in Mazamani and left at an early age to pursue music. In a new album, she shares a new appreciation for her Wisconsin roots.
I realized I had a really nice childhood, and I wish I had been more present for it because I was so focused on the future that I didn't spend enough time enjoying and appreciating the place that I grew up.
That's next. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm coming home, I'm coming home. Tell the world I'm coming home. Let the rain wash away all the pain of yesterday.
That's the voice of 5-time Grammy-nominated singer-songwriter Skylar Grey from her 2010 multi-platinum song, Coming Home.
Grey was born and raised in Mazamani in south-central Wisconsin, about 20 miles west of Madison.
Her hometown is the subject of her newest single called Nirvana, she released late last year.
It's about how she grew up resenting her small Wisconsin town, but as an adult, Grey found the beauty in her simple roots.
She joined us now to share how Mazamani inspired her new song and what it was like to return to her hometown to shoot videos for her new album. Skylar, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What drew you to writing and singing about your roots in Mazamani at this point in your career?
Man, you know, nostalgia is like the best drug ever. And I've been feeling it a lot lately. I was just realizing that like my story that most people know within the music industry and in my like, you know, fan universe, the people mostly just know the story of what I went through and the songs that I wrote and everything like after I left Wisconsin. So from my LA move when I was 17 forward, working with Eminem and all that. And that's just not like the core of who I am. And so I felt like it was time to start telling the origination story of like who I am and how I became the artist and songwriter that I am.
Now, in the song that we're going to listen to in a couple of minutes, there's a narrative definitely starting with being in Mazamani and and wanting to leave, wanting, I think, very much to leave. Where were you, say, in your teen years? What was it that made you say, yeah, I need to get somewhere else?
Well, growing up, I was always like very creative and mission oriented. I was very motivated and driven as a kid. And I started performing with my mom when I was six. And so, you know, having a career already as a kid, basically, I never really felt like I fit in. And I was always looking into the future and the future of my career, my goals. And so instead of like hanging out with kids my age or when I did, I always felt like I want to be playing the piano. I want to be writing a song. I want to be performing. Like I just like wasn't super interested in, you know, normal childhood stuff because I was so motivated and so passionate about making music. It was like the only thing I cared about. And so when I was, you know, growing up in Wisconsin with that feeling, I felt a little bit trapped there. Like I knew that if I wanted my career to go farther, I really had to leave Wisconsin. And so I was constantly just like reaching and trying to get out and trying to leave. And so I eventually did. When I was 16, I dropped out of high school. And then I made the move to LA when I was 17.
What kind of things were you thinking about that made you think, and again, we'll get into the song in a bit, but there's some stuff that you didn't appreciate at the time that in hindsight you wish you had.
Yeah. I mean, now being older and looking back, I realize I had a really nice childhood and I wish I had been more present for it because I was so focused on the future that I didn't spend enough time enjoying and appreciating the place that I grew up. And I think that's why I wanted to write these songs in a way to kind of relive my childhood through the music because I can't go back in time. So the next best thing is to do it through art.
You came back, you filmed a lot of video in Mesa Mani. What was it like looking at through the eyes of, okay, you now, but also knowing that you were putting this town on video for the rest of the world to see, what was that like for you coming back to Mesa Mani with that very different perspective?
I had so much fun. Again, I appreciate it so much more now than I did when I was a kid. I mean, I think everybody can kind of relate to that. As a kid, you're always trying to detach from your parents and move on and start your own life. But then as you grow up and you like learn about the real world and all the real struggles of adulthood and stuff, you go, actually, that wasn't so bad. And so going back for this trip to like film all this content to go with these songs, I had more fun maybe than I've ever had in Wisconsin.
You've shared some of this video. Now, I want to give a listen to a little bit. You shot video touring your childhood home, and part of it still has the same carpeting. Here's a quick listen.
It's so, like, 70s, the color of the carpet.
I love it.
Wow. And then there was the ladder thing.
Yeah.
And then I remember running from in the kitchen.
And going back to the house you grew up in for the first time in seemed like a while. Mm-hmm. What was that experience like?
It was awesome. I mean, there was still writing on the wall from when I was a kid that I wrote. They left it there, the new owners, and yeah, it brought back a lot of memories.
Now, in the song Nirvana, you've got lyrics about how you couldn't wait to leave that town. As I mentioned, you wanted to burn your childhood house down was one of the lines in the song. Looking back at that kid who wanted to leave and now enjoying being back literally in the house you grew up in, I don't know. That's like you're rethinking the narrative of your life story a little bit as you're writing this song, it seems
exactly.
Like.
Exactly. Yeah.
How did you go about like capturing that and capturing it very well, I got to say, in the short form of a song?
I mean, anytime I write a song, I just really try to focus on my emotions and how things make me feel. And I wanted to express that feeling of what it feels like to now appreciate something that I used to hate. I went through such an emotional transformation in regards to like my childhood and where I grew up. And so I wanted to, you know, put that into a song, that emotion into a song, because it's not something that I've really ever heard before. I always like to try to, you know, think outside the box and not just create run-of-the-mill song concepts. Yeah. I like to just, you know, dig into more very specific emotions and try to put things into words that I've never put into words or never heard put into words before. And so that's what I did with this song, Nirvana.
I got to say, watching you go back to your hometown reminded me of when I went back with my kids to the town I grew up, a small town in Michigan. And among other, I was taking them on a tour. I went down the dirt road I grew up on. House is still there. Went to look at my old elementary school, turned around the corner, and it was gone. The school was, like, torn down. It was a housing development now. Did you have any moments like that where you remember that thing and it's not just not there anymore?
Yeah, well, the opposite of that happened. So I grew up in Mazamani, which, you know, if anybody knows that town, it's very small. It's about 1,500 mm-hmm. people. And when I grew up there, there was no stoplight. And when I went back this time, there was a stoplight.
Whoa. It's a big city,
like,
now.
Wow, we're coming up. but things that were gone. Well, I actually didn't go to the dam, but there was this dam I used to go to as a kid right off Lake Marion. And it was really scary because you'd walk over the falling water on this little rickety bridge. And I didn't go there because I asked some friends about it, and they said that the Black Earth Creek has now been rerouted, and so
oh,
it
wow.
doesn't go through that area. And so there's no point to go to the dam because it's not running. So I was a little bit bummed about that because that was a spot I would always stop because I would walk on the railroad tracks to school and I would pass the dam like every day.
Wow.
So I didn't get to go there.
We are talking to Grammy-nominated singer-songwriter Skylar Grey about her new single, Nirvana, and learning to appreciate her small-town roots in Mazamani. Okay, I've been teasing it for a while now. Let's get a little taste. We're not going to hear the whole song. A little taste of the new song, Nirvana.
And I'm scraping ice off the windshield. Never thought I'd miss the way the cold feels. And I'm staring.
I love the line, I never thought I'd miss the way the cold feels. You moved from Mazo to L.A. What is it like to miss the cold like that?
I mean, you know, the cold gets really sucky sometimes in the winter and you're just over it. And I remember having to dig my car out of the snow in the morning if we were going to drive to school. And so that sucked and I hated it. But then when I moved to LA and there's like no seasons, it felt like time just all blended together. All the years blended together because there was no real seasonal shift to mark different points of the year. And I felt like my life was just kind of like, you know, passing me by. And so I started to really miss the seasons and also just for variety, you know, like the same thing every day, sunshine 24/7. It's just like, you know, it gets a little old.
I want to talk about the production we just heard in Nirvana there, because it really struck, like, I don't know how to put it exactly, but the atmosphere of the song feels, I think, like the emotions you're conveying. There's some nostalgia, some wistful, but also positive. There's a lot wrapped up in the way the song sounds. How did you try to capture the words and the emotions you're conveying in the sound of the song?
Well, you know, I write songs usually just vocal, piano. Mm-hmm. And then I start, after the song's pretty much written, I start thinking about, like, the atmosphere I want to create sonically to support the lyrics and the melody. And so, it takes a lot of experimentation. And then I just base everything on feeling. How does this feel? Like, at one point, I had a drum pattern in there that was, you know, the double time of that. And it just didn't feel, it just felt like I was trying to turn it into an up-tempo, like, pop song or something. Mm-hmm. And it didn't quite have the right emotion. And I wanted that long, draggy, the very sparse drum pattern. It just felt like it just fit better.
This is a single. You've got an album coming out in a couple few months now, I think. Is the whole album kind of part of this connecting with this narrative of your life before LA?
Yeah. So Nirvana was actually the last song I wrote for the album. And it was like the missing glue for the album. I had been writing a lot of kind of nostalgic songs about different moments in my childhood and things. But Nirvana was the one that kind of bundled it all together in a package where I felt like, okay, this narrative like really tells a full, complete story now. Actually, the first song I wrote for the album, or one of the first ones, was like maybe the saddest song I've ever written in my life. It's called Bruises. And I was in a kind of depressed state about a year ago when I wrote that song, because I was just feeling like, oh, I'm getting old and my career is not where I want it to be. And my whole life I've kind of struggled with just never feeling good enough. And so I wrote this song about that feeling of just like, you know, feeling not good enough in life and like friendship circles and career stuff and, you know, physically, like, you know, not feeling pretty enough or whatever. So I wrote this song that kind of embodied all of those emotions. And as soon as I wrote that song, it was so weird because I'm kind of known for my darker, sadder songs in general. Love the Way You Lie. And then I did a song with Eminem last year called Temporary. It's very, very much a tearjerker. Past Yesterday with Jelly Roll I did last year. Another like heavy subject matter. So I'm kind of like known for these like heavy subjects. But as soon as I wrote the darkest song of my life, Bruises, I felt like a weight lift off of me. Like I got it off my chest. And I suddenly was like, okay, I'm done writing sad songs. I don't want to write sad songs anymore. And so then I started like writing all these kind of more fun songs. Nirvana is somewhere in the middle, but there's some other songs. I'm about to release a song called Motivation. And it's one of the more fun songs that I've ever put out. And that one is about, it's about not having motivation. So like, as I was saying earlier, as a kid, was super motivated for my career and everything. And then when I got to LA and I went through the ringer with labels and all that stuff, the burnout came in real quick. And I started feeling less and less motivated. And so this song is like a fun up-tempo song about just like lacking motivation. But yeah, it touches on all this childhood stuff. There's a ton of lyrics in there about my childhood as well. So the whole album is kind of childhood based, going through, it's a kind of a coming of age story, you know, going through a bunch of different moments in my life and then finally coming to a resolve at the end.
Skylar, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Skylar Grey is a 5-time Grammy nominated singer and songwriter. She was with us today to share her new single, Nirvana, inspired by her childhood in Mazamani, and learning to appreciate her small town roots as a grown up. Her new album, she revealed the title will be Wasted Potential, is due out in just a few months.
We just heard from Skylar Grey about her new appreciation for the small Wisconsin town, Mazamani, she grew up in years after she left.
And maybe that's something you can relate to. Did you leave the community you grew up in? Were you eager to leave? Did your attitude toward your hometown change over time? Did you maybe even move back there?
We'd love to hear your story about your relationship with the place you grew up in and how it's changed over time. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Or you can call and leave a message or send us a text. That number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Rochelle Wilson, Mackenzie Crummy, and Lauren Cox.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.